how close are hospitals to hitting their capacity? We're looking at the trends in COVID hospitalizations, intensive care unit stays, and ventilator use here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A record 853 people were hospitalized with COVID-19 as of yesterday. 216 COVID patients are in ICU. Those are the latest figures from the Wisconsin Hospital Association. And according to the Department of Health Services, 82% of hospital beds are in use. Do you work at a hospital or clinic? What are you seeing on the ground? Is your hospital delaying elective procedures or diverting patients to other hospitals? We're at 800-642-1234. Dr. Mark Kaufman is Chief Medical Officer for the Wisconsin Hospital Association. Dr. Kaufman, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. Good morning.
Well, with the new numbers that you have published, 853 people hospitalized, 216 in ICU, what can you tell us about the situation that hospitals are in right now?
Well, unfortunately, throughout Wisconsin, the pandemic is spreading, and in almost all regions, yesterday we hit record highs of numbers of patients with COVID-19 who are in the hospital. Probably the regions of the state that are under the most stress in terms of resources at the hospital are in the North Central, Northeast, and Fox Valley. Having said that, hospitals are working together all day, collaborating, sometimes transferring staff, sometimes transferring patients, so that all Wisconsin citizens, whether they have an illness related to COVID-19 or a different health problem, can get the care that they need.
Dr. Kaufman, we had talked yesterday with the medical director for Bellin Health Emergency Services over in Green Bay, in that area of the state that is seeing such intensity. And he said, Dr. Casey said, 190 Bellin Health System employees are currently out of work in quarantine because of exposure to the virus in the community. What are staffing challenges like right now?
Staffing is a challenge depending upon the region and the system. What I think that physician was referring to was that healthcare workers in their community, but not at work, but in their community, have been exposed to people with COVID-19. And under current public health guidance, anybody who is exposed, who is a close contact, has to self-quarantine for 14 days. So if you are in an area of the state or work at a hospital, staffing can become very tight because the COVID-19 infection is spread so widely. So that is really the issue. It's community contact with patients with COVID-19, and then the healthcare worker has to self-quarantine even though he or she actually is not ill.
Is this leading to staffing shortages on the floor?
It is, depending upon the hospital and the system. Again, hospitals are, even before COVID-19, hospitals are very adept at dealing with emergencies and staffing issues. In the spring, when we were all perhaps more terrified of the first surge, all hospitals developed surge contingency plans that had to do with increasing bed capacity, personal protective equipment, and the healthcare workforce. So the good news is that those plans have been in place, and really in the last week or two, depending upon where they are in the state, those plans have put into effect.
We're talking with Dr. Mark Kaufman, who is Chief Medical Officer for the Wisconsin Hospital Association. He's giving us a briefing on what hospitals are facing in this surge. And with your insights as well, do you work at a hospital or clinic? How is your staff coping with the pandemic? What supplies are in short supply at your hospital? We're at 800-642-1234. Dr. Kaufman, do you think that Wisconsin has hit a peak in the number of cases, or do you fear that there is still the worst yet to come?
Well, you know, Kay, people talk about first surge, second surge, third surge, but I think of the pandemic in Wisconsin as a roller coaster, one continuous roller coaster ride. And if you look at the graph on the DHS website of the 7-day average of new confirmed cases, about 5 days ago, we peaked about 2,500. And just in the last few days, we're down to about 2,300. So we're on that, we passed that long uphill climb on the roller coaster, and now it seems like we might be coming down a little bit. But to give you some perspective, in the spring, we peaked at 479 daily cases, average over 7 days, and now we're almost five times that. So I think until we have better therapeutics and an effective vaccine, this will be a roller coaster ride with ups and downs, and it looks like we have just passed the highest peak and we're starting on a downslope, but time will tell.
Are we at a point where patients will be diverted to a field hospital that was built in April at the State Fairgrounds in West Dallas?
I think we'll have to see. Right now, hospitals and health systems are working within their own systems and across systems to match patient needs with hospital resources. If we all don't do our part, individually and collectively, in terms of the public health measures that we know will control the pandemic, and to that, I mean wearing a mask, physical distancing, and frequent hand washing, if we don't really do that and bring the pandemic under control, it may be that the alternative care facility in West Dallas and perhaps even others will be necessary, but hopefully not.
How long would it take to get it online?
In West Dallas, the Department of Health Services has said it would take about 7 days to bring it up and operational.
Do you think that would ease the strain on hospitals?
If it's needed, it would ease the strain on hospitals. It depends a little bit on staffing and the kinds of patients that are appropriate for that facility. I think the first thing is to maximize, you know, we want to keep patients close to their homes and, you know, in a safe environment where they can all be taken care of. So we want to use existing facilities. But if the pandemic continues to really spike, something like an alternative care facility might have to be made operational.
Let's look at the status of personal protective equipment. You keep track of hospitals that are in need of supplies. Where are you seeing any shortages of protective equipment?
Actually, PPE is not the pinch point right now. What's happened over the last 6 months since the pandemic began is that hospitals and health systems have shored up their supply lines of PPE, and I know we used to talk about ventilators, but that also is not the issue. Right now, I think the two main factors are the rapid increase in new cases across the state over the last 2 weeks, and having adequate healthcare workforce to staff the beds. In general, the physical beds are not the issue. In most places, it's having the staff available to take care of the patients in those beds.
I wonder, you know, earlier in the month, Governor Evers issued an order allowing for healthcare workers licensed in other states to practice here in Wisconsin. Are you seeing workers cross the border?
So that regulations were loosened in the spring, and WHA and our members have been working closely with the Evers administration, and I believe they have reinstituted those loosening of interstate licensure compacts and credentials for recently retired healthcare workers. So those measures that were put into place that expired in the spring are being brought back, which will help the adequacy of the healthcare workforce in Wisconsin.
Hospitals are hitting a crisis stage caring for the surge of COVID patients. We have the chief medical officer of the Wisconsin Hospital Association, Dr. Mark Kaufman, here. Do you work at a hospital or clinic? What are you seeing out there? Were you hospitalized with COVID? What was your stay like? How is your recovery going at home? When were you discharged? Be part of this conversation, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Dr. Kaufman right here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the surge in COVID-19 cases in Wisconsin and how hospitals are handling this influx of patients. According to the latest Department of Health Services data, more than 7,800 people have been hospitalized during the course of this pandemic, with almost 1,400 deaths. Do you work in healthcare? How is your hospital or clinic dealing with the surge? Do you have a number of staff in quarantine? How can you cover for them while they're out? Join in with your perspective, your situation, 800-642-1234. The Chief Medical Officer of the Wisconsin Hospital Association, Dr. Mark Kaufman, he stays with us. Dr. Kaufman, in the hospitals that you talk with, what is their protocol for testing their staff? How often are hospital workers being tested for COVID?
I think they're following public health and CDC guidance with respect to testing. One of the issues, Kate, has been that many of the providers, the hospitals and health systems, are still struggling periodically to maintain adequate testing supplies and reagents. So they are doing the best they can, and all hospitals have developed protocols in terms of testing of staff and patients, but it does vary a little bit depending upon the supply that they have.
Are they able to process those tests inside the hospital, or do they need to send them out?
The answer is yes. It depends on the it depends upon the hospital and their contracts. Some can do in-house testing with quick turnaround, and others have to send them out to organizations such as Exact Sciences or to national labs. And the longest turnaround times have really been with a number of the national labs.
Are hospitals doing anything to help stop their employees from community exposure, from getting exposed when they're off the clock, outside of work?
Hospitals, like all employers, and are really urging their employees and everyone in the community to follow the science and to use the tools that we have to control the pandemic and not to spread the infection. So wearing a mask, physically distancing, and frequently hand washing. Obviously, healthcare workers are that is their core expertise, staying healthy. So there's less education needed with healthcare workers. And they also have a bigger stake in all this because they're taking care of the patients who are coming into their facilities who need care, who are infected with COVID-19. So healthcare workers and hospitals as employers are well aware of what needs to be done.
Dr. Kaufman, earlier you just mentioned briefly ventilators, and early on in the pandemic, there was a fear that ventilators would be in short supply. And since then, physicians have come to realize that ventilators aren't always the effective treatment protocol. How often are ventilators being used here in Wisconsin?
Kate, I don't have a percentage for you, but as you alluded to, we've all learned a lot how to take better care of patients who have respiratory symptoms. And one of the learnings has been with COVID-19 patients to not use ventilators as quickly as we generally do with respiratory failure from other causes. Certainly in the early stages of the pandemic, specifically New York and internationally, there was concern about running out of ventilators. But in Wisconsin, we have never, ever even been close to ventilators being a scarce resource.
So what happens when all the hospital beds are filled? Where does the overflow go? What do you do? I mean, we talked with Green Bay yesterday. They're full. They're 100% full in their ICU.
Right. So full is a relative term. Many hospitals can flex up in terms of turning intermediate care beds into ICU beds. So that's one way to approach it. We've talked about the alternative care facility. But the other thing that hospitals do all the time and is getting a lot of focus right now is looking at scheduled elective procedures and surgeries, so the non-COVID issues. So if hospitals really feel they're going to, quote, run out of beds, end of quote, they start postponing or canceling elective surgeries and procedures temporarily to make sure that they don't really run out of beds and we can take care of everybody.
Do you see that happening anywhere right now in Wisconsin?
In select pockets, yes. Hospitals are closely scrutinizing their scheduled admissions on a daily basis or multiple times a day, and sometimes slowing down that schedule depending upon what's happening locally.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Mark Kaufman, who's Chief Medical Officer for the Wisconsin Hospital Association. He's giving us a lay of the land, if you will, on what hospitals are facing in this COVID surge and taking your questions and what you're seeing on the ground where you work in healthcare at 800-642-1234. Dr. Kaufman, have you seen hospitals try to use more respiratory care clinics for COVID patients instead of having them in the hospital? And what are you seeing there?
Kate, I'm not sure what you mean by respiratory care clinics.
Like to really focus on lungs and lung health instead of having those patients in the hospital.
Generally, we try and put people in the hospital who only need the intensity of services and close monitoring. Respiratory clinics are typically outpatient clinics where patients who have been in the hospital then are discharged, doing better, and get follow-up care. So they're really different patient needs in terms of the degree of illness and the intensity.
What's the next step for hospitals? What are you telling them?
Well, the next step for hospitals is really predicated on what is the next step for all of us as citizens in Wisconsin. You know, all of us need to focus on the science in ourselves. We need to wear a mask. We need to physically distance. We need to wash hands frequently. We should think hard about limiting private indoor gatherings, get tested if we have symptoms, and get vaccinated for influenza if there's no contraindication. If we all do that, hospitals will be in fine shape. If we don't all do that and the numbers continue to climb, and if they climb steeply, then we're into alternative care facilities and other contingency measures and canceling of, you know, or postponing more elective procedures that are necessary but can be safely postponed.
President Trump said this week that a vaccine will be here momentarily. It's imminent. Do you think that a vaccine coming before the election day is a reasonable timeline?
There may well be a vaccine in the next few months, but it's unlikely to be of significant help in the next 3 to 6 months for this pandemic. First of all, we don't have the vaccine. Whatever vaccine emerges, we need to understand the efficacy and safety data for it. As you may know, there are three vaccines in late-stage trials. Two of those, you know, are really have storage issues with needing to be stored at minus 80 degrees centigrade. If there is an effective vaccine, we're going to have to scale up manufacturing and distribution. But I think the biggest challenge for a vaccine is the long-term solution, but the biggest challenge to a vaccine helping us short-term in the next 3 to 6 months is that vaccines have relative effectiveness. The typical flu vaccine is 40 to 60% effective. All the recent polls, surveys show the public's willingness to get vaccinated early with COVID vaccine is about 50% of the population. So if the vaccine that emerges is 60% effective and only half of us are willing to take it early, you multiply those two factors and you get 30% immunity, which is not enough for herd immunity. You know, it's gonna be the solution long term, but it's not gonna be the solution even if it emerges before the election in the next 3 to 6 months.
Let's take a call now. Elaine is joining us from Elma this morning. Hi, Elaine. I understand you're a nurse.
Yes, good morning. I am. I no longer work in the hospital, but I did for 30 years.
Oh, Elaine, can you still hear us?
Yes, I can hear
you.
Okay,
go ahead. Yes.
Yes, I did work in a hospital for 30 years, and I just had a few comments.
What would you like to say very quickly here as we run out of time?
Okay, so the years that I worked in hospitals, when they said there were no beds, in fact, there were plenty of beds. It was the staff that they didn't have to take care of the people, the sick people in the beds. So I just appreciate your speaker giving good facts this morning.
Elaine, thank you for that. Dr. Kaufman, staffing is, Elaine says, is the issue.
Right now, Correct. For hospitals that are really reaching a pinch point in terms of the number of beds, it is more the staffing, the healthcare workforce availability than the physical number of beds.
Dr. Kaufman, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Mark Kaufman is Chief Medical Officer for the Wisconsin Hospital Association, and the group lobbies on behalf of more than 100 hospitals and clinics. Coming up, we talk with Amar Patel. He's running for vice president on the American Solidarity Party presidential ticket. Are you considering voting for a third-party candidate this year? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll talk about the American Solidarity Party and what it stands for right after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Just a heads up here on our programming plans today. Vice President Mike Pence and U.S. Senator Kamala Harris, they'll meet for the vice presidential candidate debate tonight at 8. We'll bring you live NPR coverage. That's live NPR coverage tonight at 8 on Wisconsin Public Radio and at WPR.org. Right now, we're talking about third-party presidential candidates and the platform of the American Solidarity Party. It is one of five parties on the ballot in Wisconsin, and we've extended invitations to all of them to come on our show. What are your thoughts on third-party candidates? Do you vote for them? What do you want to know about the American Solidarity Party? It's 800-642-1234. Amar Patel is running for vice president under the American Solidarity Party. His running mate, Brian Carroll, is running for president. Patel is the former chair of this organization. Amar, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much, Kate. I'm really, really glad to be here.
So what has compelled you to run for this position for vice president?
I'll tell you that in 2016, the election was just so very, very interesting. And researcher Lee Drutman looked into the results closely to figure out how Donald Trump was able to win the election. And he found out that about 30% of the American population, when looking at different ideological polling systems, were economically populist. And, you know, people would say that's liberal, but I think the Republicans are the ones with a liberal capitalist economics, mindset. So the populism of on the economic side and the socially center or conservative viewpoints, that's about 30% of the American population. And President Trump won those votes 3-1. And those same votes, President Obama won a majority of when he won his elections. And President Bush took those electorate in his direction. So it's a chunk of the electorate that has no representation. And so, you know, the American Solidarity Party, with our stances, falls in the dead center of that group. And we want to give those people a chance to, get their voice into the American electoral system, which right now it's totally lacking.
For people who aren't familiar with this party, what does it represent? What does it stand for? How was it founded?
Okay, so the people who dwell in this area generally want a balance between rights and responsibilities. And I think that's, you know, kind of like how families operate, you know, in the two major parties. They have a kind of a tendency to really fight for a particular set of rights. And then when it comes to the responsibilities that they should have to the common good, they don't really ever live those out truly. So we would say we want the totality of the dignity of human life from womb to tomb, as we would say. And then the justice for the worker, an economic model that's fair and has more of a distributist mindset of ownership. And then even like a healthy and sustainable environment for our future generations, for our children.
All right. So starting with that first stance, in your views on abortion here, because abortion is a very much a voting decision at the ballot box. Where do you stand on abortion law in America?
Yes. And so, you know, we are strongly against strongly for the right to life. And when we say that, we are a both and party. So we understand that there are difficulties from the pro-choice side, they would say there's reasons that women have abortion. And, you know, to understand that fully, you know, we would say that abortion isn't the problem. It's a symptom of how we have fallen so far from taking care of the responsibility of our primal relationships. And nothing is more primal than the relationship of a mother and her child. And so we would say that, you know, to ameliorate the problems and those issues that force those decisions, it's very rarely a choice. It's almost something that is put upon a woman, is that, you know, we should have health care from the second a woman is, well, actually, I mean, obviously, we believe in universal health care, so that even gynecological care should be covered before a woman gets pregnant, in education for pregnancy and so forth. But, you know, after a woman becomes pregnant, there should be no concern for her, for health care, for the care of her delivery, for the child afterwards. And there should be a kind of a robust system for an investment for our children and our young families and our mothers, whether they are, you know, single mothers or within families, to get the support they need and not to feel any kind of pressure to have an abortion.
Brian Carroll, your running mate, supports a constitutional amendment saying there is no right to obtain an abortion. Can you explain that for us?
Yeah, I would say that, you know, the human life amendment would be an extension of our rights in the Constitution, and to say that not just, you know, every person who's born should have the right to life and to right to freedom, but every person who is created. And so, you know, if you the big conflict that we have, and going back to Roe v. Wade, but even before then, is this, you know, in 1973, we knew so little about the development of human life. You know, if the justices at that time had like 4D technology or knew, you know, the microbiology of how conception and then when like a human heart began to beat and when electrical brain signals started, you know, would that decision have been the same? And so, you know, the battle right now is over Roe v. Wade, but the constitutional battle would be not to even go to Roe v. Wade. And I think that's why we would say a human life amendment. But you know what, to be honest, Kate, like we're very far from that in the culture, right? We need to make a culture of life where people respect all human dignity. And we believe in the American Solidarity Party and many other Americans that, you know, if you look at human life as expendable at the beginning, then all of these other things that we are consistent on with immigration, with healthcare, with, you know, right now we have a lot of racial justice issues, those things all kind of fall apart because, you know, the mindset of human dignity, you know, is a foundation on its beginning. And so that's what we would say.
We're going to talk about systemic racism in a moment, but I want to reintroduce you. Amar Patel is running for vice president under the American Solidarity Party. We're exploring third-party candidates and extending invitations to them. What do you want to ask Amar Patel about his platform? What do you want to know about the American Solidarity Party? Join in at 800-642-1234. Amar, one of the hugest issues, of course, in our country is the coronavirus pandemic and millions of cases in the U.S., over 200,000 deaths, still spreading very rapidly in Wisconsin. As vice president, how would you address this virus?
You know, one thing I would say that it, kind of looking from the outside as a person who, you know, is really paying attention to politics, obviously, in this year we're running for election, the two parties have run on all of the topics that they run on, it seems that they're always going on either fear or some kind of appeal to freedom, personal rights. And it flip-flops on which side they're going to take on any particular issue. So for coronavirus, you know, the Democrats have used fear and the Republicans have called for rights. But in immigration, the Republicans use fear and the Democrats call for rights. And I think regardless of how that's approached, the general outcome in our American mindset is atomization. You know, we really are reduced to individuals because we're either afraid or we're clamoring for our individual rights. But what we really should be considering is how should we be acting and how should we be relating to each other for the common good? And so one thing that one of our team members, Charlie Camosi, said is that social distancing is like the worst word to be using at a time like this, that physical distancing is so important and the usage of masks and, you know, quarantining and staying at home and all those kind of things. We really need more social connection now more than ever. And I feel like that's kind of one of the big problems the party's had. In terms of actual addressing the coronavirus, I mean, one thing that I live in Illinois, and Abbott Labs came out with a 15-minute COVID test. And, you know, President Trump came out in front of the White House and made this big press conference that we have this great test. That was in March. And what I called for consistently and did not get much traction was, why didn't President Trump enforce compulsory licensing laws that we have in this country in this very, very situation when there's some kind of a pandemic or a national emergency, to get that technology to other producers and then use the Defense Production Act to get millions and millions and millions of tests out there, you know, by April, so that we could have quashed this very early on by knowing exactly where the problems were. You know, we had epicenters that were, you know, generally in our major cities where large population centers are. And we could have handled this so much better. But, you know, it looks like the answer there was corporate money, that they just didn't want to, you know, fight with corporations on what they should be free to do.
Okay, so on the issue of testing there, you would certainly encourage more rapid testing and allow more tests to come to market. But on the issue of therapeutics and vaccines, we've seen emergency use authorizations. How would you get a vaccine to market?
You know, that's a great question. I mean, in terms of vaccine production, you know, when the call was made that we should have a vaccine immediately, I think most people don't understand how that process works. In the testing, you know, phases of that are so critical. And so we've already seen a couple of times where, you know, some major vaccine producer had to stall their testing phase because there were reactions. Well, this happens all the time. You know, because we're in a pandemic and COVID, it's such a big news item that, you know, that came out very easily. But like in all kinds of other testing phases of vaccines, they have roadblocks. And so, you know, obviously I would want to get a vaccine to market as soon as possible. But at the same time, it has to be safe. And you don't want, you know, millions of people's reactions or dying from a vaccine that was rushed to market where, you know, it's not going to, the end, you know, does not justify the means there.
So the last third-party candidate to win a state was George Wallace of the American Independent Party in 1968. Why run as a third party?
That's a question that's asked constantly of us. And I think one of the advantages, and I think compared to a lot of the other the third-party candidates that come out. And so, for example, the Green Party is further populist and further socially, let's say, liberal than the Democrats. And then the Constitution Party is further liberal in capitalism and further conservative than the Republican Party. And the Libertarians are in a quadrant that very few people actually, according to this researcher, say, dwell in, right? We're in a place where there is no third party that's running this place as a party. There are individuals that are out there. They're actually running on very similar platforms. Like Mark Charles is a person I can think of. Jade Simmons is another independent who is running, and they're kind of running in our quadrant. But as a party, I feel like we have a space that has millions of people that could gather around us. And, you know, it's a place where we can really start to make a dent in American politics.
Well,
we
let's pause there with Amar Patel on the ticket of the American Solidarity Party in a bid for the presidency. We'll be back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with the American Solidarity Party. Amar Patel is running for vice president on the ticket. We're exploring his platform and the role of third-party candidates 27 days before the election. There are 5 parties on the ballot in Wisconsin. We've extended invitations to all of them. Amar, let's take a look now at systemic racism. This summer, spring and summer, protests erupted across the globe after George Floyd was killed by a police officer in Minneapolis. Here in Kenosha, Wisconsin, it was Jacob Blake that triggered more protests. How would you address systemic racism as vice president?
The killing of George Floyd really resonated with me. As a child growing up, an Indian child in a completely white neighborhood, you know, I was picked on. I kind of went through a lot of just prejudices that you know, people that had ignorance of other people. And what stuck with me with George Floyd is that, you know, watching him, you know, no one did anything when he was slowly dying. And I remember being on like a playground it kind of brought back memories of that feeling of like no one cares, you know. And I totally empathize with that feeling of abandonment. And I think one of the things that our party, and we would say the American Solidarity Party is founded on the principles of European and even South American Christian democracy. And those principles are not wholly Christian. They are, you know, about solidarity, subsidiarity, trying to have government be as localized as possible, but as, you know, as big as it needs to be. Personalism, that the dignity of the human person is, you know, paramount. But one of the things that I think that resonates with people, whether they're Christian or not, is that they're to overcome some kind of injustice, like we've had in our racial injustice from slavery to Jim Crow to redlining. You know, there has to be a moment, there has to be a point of suffering collectively, you know, for the person who is suffering, to suffer with them. And so we call it, you know, in Christian democracy, you have to carry the cross with your brother, right? You have to help that person. And I think that's the biggest thing that the American Solidarity Party would say is that we don't have those relationships anymore. We don't look to form those relationships. In fact, the very exact opposite is occurring in our political system, is where relationships continue to break down. So our neighbor becomes just the person that lives next to you, not a significant important member of your life or a person in your life. And so, you know, it just happens to be, I'm not sure if you're well aware of this, Kate, but Pope Francis just put out an encyclical, Fratelli Tutti, and the entire encyclical is specifically about this moment in time where we are atomizing into individuals when we need to reverse that for our entire world, you know, and he's writing to the world. It's not about American political issues, but I actually joked and wrote a tweet saying, thank you, Pope Francis, for endorsing our candidacy. And, you know, oh, sorry, it was an encyclical. I didn't catch that. Sorry, my bad. But it was that kind of, you know, that message was so on top of what we're trying to say, is that we are falling apart and there has to be an active way to get back together.
Okay, so how does it translate into policy, though?
Right. And so for systemic racism, for very, very specifically, is one of the things that we've done is we've taken away. And then the give back has been throwing cash, right? It was that the infusion of money into large cities. And a lot of times, you know, in our large bureaucratic cities, we don't use that. You know, it gets lost in the translation of the bureaucracy and it doesn't get to the people. So redlining, I'll give you a very specific example, is that money should be used to invest in those depressed neighborhoods, not to wait until they become so cheap that outside, like, high capital investors can come in and build high rises and push the tenants out even further, but to put in smaller, modest homes with very low interest loans, to support those loans with local jobs in a you know, maybe a cooperative environment, a lot of co-op jobs, local markets, local farms. There's definitely great programs out there. Strong Towns is an organization that does an amazing job of explaining how this can be done to have a sustainable local income for, you know, low income members of society, and make it, like I said, sustainable and make it something that can grow over time. You know, we've taken away things from our Black brothers and sisters for so long that, you know, it has to be built back. And so policy has to be directed towards the building back of wealth. And it has to be over time, too. And that's the problem, is nothing, you know, as you know, Kate, nothing really lasts long enough. It has to be also a philosophical view in our culture to look a little bit more long term. And that's one of the biggest problems. Every 4 years, we want to change our minds.
What do you feel about reparations or direct cash payments?
You know, I think that's a great question. I feel like the direct cash payments, they may not direct cash payments, but direct investment opportunities and to support those. And so it could be like a one-to-one where we're going to give you this kind of money to invest into like a local business or into a local, into a home ownership. And then we're going to support you with equal cash if you make, you know, if to support that into and with education to support long-term income growth and educational opportunities and, you know, improvement of future work opportunities.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Amar Patel, running for vice president under the American Solidarity Party. We're learning about his platform, taking your questions for a third-party candidate. You can join in at 800-642-1234. You mentioned off the top worker justice, and, you know, millions of Americans are out of jobs right now, seeking social safety net programs, unemployment, food banks due to the pandemic. What needs to be done right now for American workers?
Yeah, I think something that people just don't grasp in this country anymore is that there aren't two economic systems. You know, people think, oh, there's socialism or there's capitalism. And what we say in the American Solidarity Party is the goal should be to have widespread ownership in the workplace. And so, the way to incentivize that through policy would be, well, I'll give you an example that it was not an incentive. That President Trump cut the corporate tax rate to 15% across the board with no strings attached. And so you saw tons of companies, their stock prices rose up because they were buying their own stock back with all the money they were now flush with that they didn't have to pay the federal government. They didn't use it on their employees. They didn't use it to grow their companies. They just bought their own stock. And so what we would say is there should be an incentive, or maybe at least disincentivize companies to have such huge income disparity by saying, all right, if your salary and your benefits of the median worker are, you know, let's say $50,000, then if you can keep your highest paid person, your CEO, to be 20 times that, right, that's still $1 million. Then you can have a tax break. But if you're going to pay that person $20 million or some multiplier, and I'm not going to say what the right numbers are. Someone would have to crunch those numbers. But that income disparity then basically creates people living two different sets of lives. Mm. And the wealth disparity is obviously the same thing. And so when you talk about solidarity and understanding, you know, racial disparity and economic injustice for workers, you know, that's one way to close that loophole. Another one would be to take away the income, the Social Security tax cap, right, at $130,000. I know that would force companies to reconsider paying someone $30 million for a salary when they have to pay 6% on all of that to the federal government. And then the worker would also have to pay 6% of that to the federal government. Right now, it's capped at like $135,000. So any money made above that, no one pays any tax to. Those will be ways to kind of get the democracy in the workplace, right?
So I want to make sure I get in this question though, because it goes along where you're headed here. But the federal minimum wage at $7.25 an hour, would you support raising the minimum wage?
I would, you know, and I would say that we should really consider though having minimum ownership. You know, so a minimum wage is kind of where we're at in our mindset, in our culture. So it's really hard for people to wrap their minds around, well, what would minimum ownership look like? And what I mean by that is there a way possibly to say when someone's working full time, after a certain amount of time that they've established maybe loyalty to the company, I don't know what that is, like 5 years or so, that they be given part of the profits of the company before anyone else gets profits that isn't working there? You know, and people say, well, what about stockholders? Okay, that's our system right now. But what can you conceive of a world where we incentivize the workers who are working at a place to get the profits, that they are the stockholders? I mean, they're the ones that hold the interest of the company, and that would increase productivity and moral investment into their own companies.
Amar, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I really, really appreciate it.
Amar Patel is running for vice president under the American Solidarity Party. Just ahead, the head of the National Museum of the American Indian joins us to talk about the historical erasure of Native American culture. That's just ahead. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.